Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. We have on with us this time David Pfeiffer, and he is a paramedic who I think is probably one of the coolest paramedics I know because he has probably one of the best beards, but he also does other stuff too. But David, I got to first know, how long did it take you to grow that beard?
Well, all right, so fundamentally...
You weren't expecting that word.
Yeah. Well, it's a complicated answer, actually, because I can grow pretty decent coverage in about a week. Now, to get it to the thickness and the exact shape that I might want, you know, that might take a few weeks, like the average man. But I am both blessed and cursed to be able to grow body hair rapidly. So I can lay it down pretty nicely after a few days. But actually, I don't
need to know where else you have body hair. We just wanted to focus on the beard, David. Come on.
Don't ask questions you don't want the answer to. But actually, right now, as we record, I don't have a beard. I am experimenting with a handlebar mustache.
Oh.
Yeah,
we're gonna have to end this conversation. Thanks, David, for coming on.
I did this to myself. It's my I shaved my credibility off, and now nobody wants me. So. Yeah, I have some fit testing coming up for one of my employers, and
it's kind of hard, especially with the nice beard. I'm gonna have to include a picture of the fullness of the beard because it is impressive. But yeah, I guess if you have to do a fit test, you're gonna have to shave it off a little bit.
Yeah. So
I had the firefighter handlebar mustache.
I do. I am going for kind of a Pringles man look. And ooh. I'm getting there. It looks a little it looks a little silly if I'm being honest right now, but you gotta start somewhere. The first beard I ever grew, you know, wasn't the one that I'm proudest of. So you just have to have the confidence. If you're listening out there and you're thinking about trying something new with your facial hair, just be confident and own it and go with it.
So I'm going to have to edit that part out. Otherwise, my wife is going to be like, this is the thing. Now you can try and grow a beard. See, I just don't have the, how'd you put it? The full facial coverage for it. So my 5 o'clock shadow takes about 5 days to develop, which is kind of nice because I can just, you know, screw off and let it grow for a little bit.
Right.
But yeah, it's kind of paid off as a result I have to shave to actually look halfway decent.
Well, you have to be true to yourself. You have to be true to your face. But this, you know, it comes there are downsides to be able to grow nice thick facial hair. I look sloppy if I don't keep up with it, you know. I look real ragged if I don't really pay attention to it. So it requires a lot of maintenance. So don't sweat, you know. Don't feel too bad about not being able to grow a beard.
I'll try and remember that. So we are not on here, though, to talk about facial hair, are we, David?
I don't know.
We're on something else. I don't know. We've talked about a couple of different things, and I guess there's going to be a separate podcast because we had such a great discussion about the nocebo effect.
Yeah.
But yeah, so David, tell us actually first, before we dive in too much, because there's too many different things. I don't know how to sum you up other than to say you have a great beard and you're a paramedic. So how would you describe yourself?
I am a paramedic who specializes in wilderness and austere medicine. That's it in a nutshell. That's really my jam. I think like a lot of paramedics, I have my fingers in a few different pots and do a lot of things, you know, part-time and volunteering and have some different interests. But over the years, that's really where my focus has led me. In my full-time job, I'm a professor. I teach in the paramedic degree program at Eastern Kentucky University. Beyond that, the rest of the stuff that I'm into really all centers around the wilderness and kind of austere and a little bit of disaster medicine too.
Nice. And yes, you've actually, that's where I've noticed you've really hit things hard. And you actually have a podcast too.
I do. I have my own podcast. It's all about beards in EMS, actually. So we only have about two episodes because there's not really much you can say about that. No, my podcast is the Raw Medicine Podcast, and RAW stands for Remote, Austere, and Wilderness. And I co-host it with my friend and colleague, Seth Collins Hawkins. He's a wilderness emergency physician based out of North Carolina. And we have a few episodes out. When we first started it, we thought it was going to be a monthly thing and we'd rack up a bunch of episodes by now. But it actually turns out that recording podcasts takes a lot of time. So we kind of just do it sporadically, but we have a few episodes out there if anybody's interested in listening.
I have enjoyed the Raw podcast. If you have listened to it, you definitely should check it out. You don't have to be some people I think, oh, this is an EMS style podcast. Why should I listen to it if I work in the ED? But I would argue you really need to understand all different types of medicine. And you guys do such a good job, I feel like, talking about the spectrum and like other levels of it. So it's kind of like foam frat in the same sense, not to like, bring up another podcast in the mix of this, but I take away pearls every time I listen to someone else's podcast, even though I'm working primarily in the ED and some of the time I get to play out and about in the pre-hospital setting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, that's really, it's a high honor coming from you. What we try to do on our podcast is that Seth, my co-host, is really, he's a brilliant guy, and he's very philosophical, and actually another thing I'm passionate about is education for paramedics, degree standards for paramedics, and the benefits of liberal arts education in healthcare. And Seth, actually, his undergraduate training is in the humanities, and he's an anthropologist at heart, and he really likes talking about some of the philosophical aspects of wilderness medicine and emergency care generally. And I am none of those things. I am a dum-dum, and I'm very like task oriented. And I really, if I'm being a little bit more serious, I do think of myself as kind of an applied science kind of a guy, whereas Seth is a little bit more philosophical. And we try to blend those things. We try to talk both about process and mindsets and paradigms of thought, deliver some useful clinical pearls. So hopefully we're doing that for our listeners. Sometimes we just get on there and ramble and talk about random stuff.
Well, I enjoy it though. And even sometimes rambling is a good thing. I mean, like beards, for example.
Right.
So let's talk about something that you've really been pushing as of late. And I think is something that most of us probably have an idea in our head already, which it's hard to get rid of bad habits, which is why I wanted to have you on, because you did such a good job educating. You kind of created your own little infographic, I believe, mm-hmm. and you've really driven home some of the key points between heat exhaustion and heat stroke, because I feel like everyone screws this up in some way. I know there are things that I took as a misconception from previous times I was taught about them. And I started looking at your infographic and thought, oh, I'm not as smart as thought I was. So let's go ahead and let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, the first thing is that infographic was a collaboration. That graphic was designed by me and Seth, our friend Tim Durkin, who's a sports medicine and EMED physician, right now based out of Colorado, really extensive experience in search and rescue. He's been on several mountain rescue teams out west. He's also the medical director for a wilderness medical training company called Base Medical. He does a lot of support for marathons and foot races and trail races and that kind of stuff. Really, really knows a lot about it. He also wrote his own handbook for sports and environmental medicine, which you can find on Amazon, which I highly recommend. So that's Tim Durkin. And then the fourth guy is Todd Schimmelfennig. He's the director of curriculum for Knowles Wilderness Medicine based in Lander, Wyoming. And we actually collaborated on coming up with that graphic in support of an episode that we did called Orange Man Must Die. And Orange Man is this graphic from the National Weather Service, specifically out of the Sacramento National Weather Service office, that pops up on Facebook every single year, every summer when the weather starts to get warm. And if most people have seen it, I'm sure some people listening have not, but you've probably seen it. It's a outline of a man. It's kind of split down the middle. One half the man is yellow, one half the man is red, and it lists the signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion versus heat stroke. And it's all wrong. It's not right. It's not correct. And even on the parts that it is correct about, it kind of gives short shrift to the most salient pieces of information, like how to treat the things. It's really just, in my opinion, just misinformation. And so we decided to come up with our own graphic. So we collaborate on that in advance of the episode that we were going to record. And then I did the graphic designing. So I will take credit for the layout. I actually have I'm a little bit of a hobbyist graphic designer. And so we all contributed to the content. That's what that's about. So the episode is Orange Man Must Die. That's what we named that weather service graphic was Orange Man. And this is designed to really replace it. So, what's cool is that lately it seems like it's gotten a lot of traction. It's actually being shared by some of the groups like SAR teams and other people like that who used to share Orange Man last year. Now they're sharing the Raw Medicine podcast. So that's pretty cool.
I want people to listen to your podcast. So I don't want to be a bunch of redundancies as far as like what's covered there. I figure we could talk about a little more of the highlights and some of the pearls and pitfalls specifically with the differences with heat exhaustion, heat stroke. What should we actually know versus what we get misinformed on?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm at the fair with my family and I got this person passed out on the ground who someone said that they're overheated.
Mm-hmm.
How can I take the information that I can get just looking at this person and just doing a real basic assessment, a first responder level type of assessment, because I don't have any special diagnostic equipment with me,
yeah.
Which is rarity for me, but let's say I don't have anything like that. How can I just eyeball that person and differentiate heat exhaustion versus heat stroke?
So the biggest pearl, the biggest takeaway, the most important thing to understand about this category of health emergency is that a patient who's coming out of a hot environment and who has altered mental status is heat stroke until proven otherwise. So there's a lot of other explanations for what could be causing that, right? They could have low blood sugar. They could have had head trauma. They could have had some electrolyte imbalances. There's all kinds of things that could cause that.
Way
but
too much alcohol.
Yeah. That's affair, remember? Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. None of those things are going to be as immediately fatal or have as high morbidity as heat stroke. So if to put this in like clinical terms, if they're coming out of a hot environment or a hot nature of illness or mechanism of injury, and they have altered sensorium, right? So it's broader than just altered mental status. It can include seizures, altered gait, agitation. I mean, the whole spectrum of altered sensorium all to the point of being unresponsive. If it's any of those things, right? Hot and altered sensorium, heat stroke until proven otherwise. To put this kind of in layman's terms, if we're talking about that, if we're talking about lay people or maybe just very, very minimal training, like first aid training, I like a teaching point that I use sometimes is if they're hot and bothered, right? And then I go on to explain to the audience what I really mean by hot and bothered. But I kind of want that concept to stick with them, it's heat stroke until proven otherwise. So, you know, if it's any of those other things that we mentioned as potentially causing it, you know, I would argue that, let's say that you have first aid, you're limited to first aid skills or abilities. If it's one of those other problems, assuming that help is on the way, so we're talking like a county fair, the patient probably has time until trained healthcare providers get there to do maybe a little bit more, you know, sophisticated assessment and stuff like that, and with some treatments. But if it's heat stroke, time really is of the essence. And if we don't cool the patient aggressively and kind of consistently, so in other words, initiate cooling and then don't disrupt it, mortality is super, super high. It's depending on the sources you read, anywhere from like 60 to 80% mortality. And morbidity is really, really high as well. So anywhere, again, depending on sources, from like 60 to like 90% permanent disabilities from people who survive that heat stroke. So it's really important to try to hone in on that, altered sensorium, a patient who's not acting right, not talking right, not making sense, maybe seizing, maybe weakness and ataxia, those kinds of things. And if you feel like they've been, you know, in a super hot environment or exerting themselves or something like that, start cooling them. You're not going to hurt them if it's not heat stroke. It's not like you're going to like induce hypothermia or anything like that. So you're not going to hurt them by cooling them aggressively, but you may in fact really save their life.
And just to clarify, because you mentioned morbidity, like what kind of long-term morbidity are we talking about?
You know, all kinds of neurological impairments. I have a colleague of mine who is a firefighter. He suffered heat stroke on the fire ground, but it went unrecognized and wasn't treated, especially aggressively because it didn't go unrecognized. And his wife has actually been very forthcoming on Facebook about sharing information about his clinical course. She's a nurse. He's a paramedic firefighter. I actually found one of her old posts thinking that we might get into this on the podcast. And she said that since the diagnosis of his since the heat stroke occurred when he was on the fire ground, he's had four hospitalizations, months and months of rehab to learn how to walk, relearn how to write, relearn how to do activities of daily living, and has had really significant memory problems. And when you look at the research, and the literature about heat stroke survivors, that's really, really common. A whole spectrum of really, really serious neurological impairment that they deal with.
And that's what I've taken away from the morbidity research and what I've seen in the past with this is that there's a reason why it's heat stroke. It reminds me of the issues that you run into with your traditional ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke patients is a lot of this translates in some form or fashion to a physical type of rehabilitation that they'll need because they have some sort of impairment as a result with it.
Right.
Versus heat exhaustion, in a nutshell, it seems like, yeah, you'll get over it and you'll get better as long as it doesn't progress and involve other systems as well.
Yeah. I mean, heat exhaustion needs to be taken seriously. It certainly puts somebody at greater risk for heat stroke in the sense that they're dealing with a heat load that they're having maybe a little bit of a hard time dealing with. So if they don't, you know, if they just continue to exert themselves, continue to not dissipate that heat, then they might have heat stroke. Although it's important to point out that it's not like a linear continuum with stops on the way. You can experience heat stroke without having suffered heat exhaustion first. Right. But, you know, we should still take heat exhaustion seriously because it means somebody is struggling with the heat, but it's also I think pretty common. I actually think that like most people at some point in their life have been doing something in a hot environment, whether it's exerting themselves working out or playing sports or hiking or going through a fire academy or a military boot camp. Almost everybody has had that kind of an experience where they've been doing those kinds of things and they don't feel good. You know, they don't feel good. They're overheating. They're getting a little bit too hot. They're thirsty. And they just feel weak and fatigued and nauseous and, you know, just dripping with sweat and they're just miserable out in the heat. That's heat exhaustion. So it's very, very common, especially if people aren't well conditioned. So, you know, as long as you kind of recognize that and don't try to, you know, like prove something to the people you're with or be a hero or something like that and just take a break, that's pretty easy to recover from. Might take you longer than you might think to recover from it. You might have to kind of end the activity for the day, but, you know, you find some shade, find some air conditioning, find a fan, drink some water, loosen your clothing, that kind of stuff. And basically, if you just kind of like stop the activity and then, you know, take some like logical, intuitive steps to cool down, you'll be fine. That is distinct from heat stroke, where you're not just going to be fine if you stop. The patient is not just going to be fine if they stop the hot activity. They need active, aggressive cooling applied to them. And that's the big difference in your approach to the two.
And that was the way I kind of remembered it with trying to differentiate between heat exhaustion and heat stroke as far as management goes, was that exhaustion, just think of it like what it is. They're tired, you know, give them a chance to rest, cool them off, not actively, not aggressively in the same manner as with the heat stroke patients, but, you know, put them in that cooler environment, give them fluids to drink, not necessarily IV fluids, right?
Right.
But give them a chance to basically rest. And like you said, it should de-escalate with time. And sometimes you may have to help them out to a degree, but versus heat stroke, you have to do something about it. And you mentioned the active cooling. Can you kind of go into a little more detail of what that entails?
Yeah. So for a heat stroke patient, they need active cooling. And the gold standard is cold water immersion. And actually, more specifically, ice water immersion. So all of the literature about heat stroke really comes to the same conclusion, which is that you need to cool the patient down to less than about 104 degrees Fahrenheit core temp as quickly as possible. All right, so it's all about what is the quickest, most thermally efficient way to cool a patient. And it's cold water immersion, right? That's what the science really proves. So what the gold standard looks like is having like a like an ice bath, like a trough, like a 50-gallon tub or stock tank or horse trough or, you know, something along those lines, filled about halfway with ice water. And, you know, hopefully that ice water mixture has been in there enough time to actually get cold, right? So like, let's think of something like a sporting event where you have medical staff or athletic trainers or somebody, you know, like that on site, and they have set this up and it's nice and chilly. It's a true ice bath. And when a patient comes in who is suspected of being in heat stroke or confirmed as being in heat stroke through getting a quick core temp, you place them in that ice water. And the goal is to immerse them, not submerge them, but immerse them basically up to their neck or maybe their chin. And then you can also take some, you know, icy ice water soaked towels and drape them over their head and neck and stuff like that. So that's the gold standard. So if you don't have those kinds of resources available to you, and, you know, a paramedic on an ambulance, for example, is probably not going to have that kind of modality available to them, then the question becomes kind of how close to that gold standard modality can we get? And there's some specific things that have been proven to be effective in cooling rapidly and effectively, and other things that seem like they might be effective, but really just aren't. So, you know, ice water immersion again is really the gold standard, and you want to think about like how can we replicate what I just described, right? A stock tank filled with ice water. So there are some techniques that need to be practiced and that kind of need to be stocked for in terms of supplies that can come close to that. Like there's a method where you can take a tarp and kind of fold in the edges and, you know, kind of make a little containment pool, almost like you might do for some hazmat decon kinds of things. So you kind of roll up the edges and kind of pull it up around the patient to make like a little bit of a tarp hammock cocoon kind of a thing with some rolled edges. And you could maybe try to fill that with some cool water. You could try to, there's some techniques I've been experimented with where you actually take a body bag off your ambulance and introduce cold water into that. So the patient is kind of in this like, you know, ice water cocoon. You might be able to, you know, add things that maybe aren't ice water, but still cool water. And water is an extremely efficient thermal conductive medium. So almost any kind of water, assuming it's not hot water, almost any kind of water you introduce to the patient is going to help dissipate that heat. So maybe you could just dump a cooler off of a fire truck, like a rehab cooler. Maybe you could just fill up that tarp or body bag or start dousing the patient with a fire hose. Maybe it's a garden hose. Maybe you could drag them into a swimming pool or a body of water. But again, the concept is, okay, I have this image in my mind of a ice water, essentially like an ice water dunk tank. How close can I get to that modality with the supplies that I have on hand. From that point, it's really just getting kind of less and less efficient the farther you get away from that standard. So if you can't douse somebody in cool water or keep them kind of immersed in cool water, then you might be able to apply moist sheets to their body to just kind of, you know, help dissipate some of that heat or absorb some of that heat. Maybe you're down to just fanning them, like removing their clothing and trying to generate like, you know, convective kind of a cooling force with fanning motions and, you know, materials to actually create a fan. Maybe you're using an actual powered fan. You know, but those things are certainly not as efficient as cooling. What really doesn't work very much at all is ice packs and IV fluids.
Now, are you talking about normal temperature IV fluids, or are you talking about like chilled IV fluids?
Either one just doesn't work that much. And I was going to say, I feel like I've been talking for a while and I should take a break for you to say some things.
Well, I was just sitting back and listening to all the pearls. I think one thing that needs to go mentioned, because someone out there is probably thinking, is why can't I just give Tylenol?
Well, it's a good question. You know, so Tylenol is an antipyretic, right? It's designed to inhibit the body's production of elevated temperatures as a specific response to trying to essentially cook off a pathogen or as a result of an inflammatory process, right? That's the other reason people get fever sometimes. Neither of those things is what's occurring with heat stroke. The exact like physiological pathway of heat stroke is actually not completely well understood. But it's not going to respond to antipyretics. What's going on with heat stroke is really about essentially external heat that the body is having a hard time basically processing or dissipating, right? So Tylenol is not going to address the fact that the patient has been roasting out in the sun or exerting themselves or confined to a hot environment or wasn't able to sweat efficiently, right? Tylenol is not going to address any of those things. So Tylenol has no role in dealing with heat stroke. It's for people who have what you might call an organic fever, but that's not what heat stroke is.
Well, and the way I also think about it is that Tylenol, which acetaminophen, paracetamol for other people, as well as like NSAIDs, they're more directed at the hypothalamus. That's what it's helping regulate is hypothalamic control of temperature. And just like you said, this is an external cause of the heat. So this is related to outside temperatures. Mm-hmm. This is related to basically their production as a result with it. And it's kind of the same reason why you get the people who have ecstasy on board and they get hyperthalamic. It's not, I said hyperthalamic, and that's not
hyperthermic.
Hyperthermic.
Are you having altered sensorium right now? Are you in heat stroke?
Yeah. I actually, you know, it's pretty damn hot outside, yeah. But I did not come from a hot area in here, at least not in the last about hour or so. but truly, I mean, that's the big thing is these are not things that are regulated by the thalamus versus a fever that your body's trying to purposely produce and will stay regulated. Like the highest that really your thalamus will regulate up to is about 105, 106 range. And then 108 is really not something organic. It's usually an external cause, whether it's from drugs or exposure or stuff like that. So I think that's just something worth remembering because I've been in those scenarios where we have a very warm patient and they've had the highest temperature I've ever dealt with was 108.6 Fahrenheit. Not exactly sure what that is in Celsius. But that person was hot. And I remember someone actually specifically wanting to use rectal Tylenol to try and take care of it. And I shot that down real quick.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least it got them something to do and you know, kind of it was helpful at least in some way to kind of generate discussion, but it really was down to active cooling like we're talking about. I have used because in certain situations where I couldn't do the ice bath, we did do the cooling measures. Like we tried to get the cold like blankets and put them like cold, wet blankets. But the fastest thing that I found in that scenario, and this is purely anecdote, so this is why I always like hearing other stuff, because looking back, I kind of wonder, well, how much did everything else come to play? But I put in a nice big line and dropped a couple of liters of wheat. I actually had them put it in the freezer for a few minutes to get it as cold as possible, and then ran it through. And we dropped the temperature down. By the time we flew that person out, we dropped them by 8 degrees.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how long did that take?
30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
From start to finish, we dropped them 8 degrees in 30 minutes. But that was like with a lot of coordination, with a lot of extra hands,
right,
and really trying to do a multimodal approach.
And so it sounds like too that was like truly freezing cold fluids.
Yes, that was my point. Is like this is not the just like get it from the Omni or get it from someone who has it like stored in like a little temperature controlled environment. I'm talking about we literally stuck it in the freezer and then pumped it through.
Yeah. So, you know, the thing about IV fluids is that certainly if you are on an ambulance or in, I think, most pre-hospital situations encountering these patients, you're just not going to be able to get your fluid that cold. And even fluid that might feel cold, and, you know, room temperature fluid is actually like pretty cold. I mean, right? The normal body temperature is, you know, 98.6 is like a reference point, give or take a little bit actually in reality, but let's go with 98.6 Fahrenheit. So if you're giving somebody 72 degree IV fluid, that's actually a pretty significant temperature gradient, and that's you know, cold fluid. But it's not enough, right? I mean, just based on the rates of fluid administration, based on the rates of circulation, based on a number of just like fluid physics factors, the research really finds that it's just not going to cool the patient as quickly as is necessary. And that's really the key thing. Like, would it cool them in general? It would, especially if you kept giving it. But these heat stroke patients, you really want to cool them as rapidly as possible. The minimal rate of cooling that you're shooting for is actually about 0.15 degrees Celsius per minute. And the real goal is to cool them even faster than that, even as quickly, more quickly than that. So the cold water immersion therapy that we've been talking about, that's been found to cool at a rate of about 0.22 degrees Celsius per minute. That's about as fast as you would be able to really kind of cool them down. And so this is all about the time factor. And as I say those numbers, I'm trying to double check my own terrible comfort with the metric system to make sure that my points are in the right place. So we might have to edit some things in post here, but let me hone in on this point. Cooling them as fast as possible, right? And the IV fluid just doesn't do that. It sounds like in your case it did, but I think you also mentioned you had some other things going on. That was like exactly one therapy as part of a multimodal therapy.
Yeah, again, this was access to resources that are not usually present. I agree the ice bath is the way to go. Like, if you can do that cold water immersion, because especially, like you said, it's hard to A, get IV fluids that cold, and B, it's literally ice. I mean, and you're dunking the whole body in it. It's a huge gain. But yeah, we used, so this is one of the few times, and this is partly because this was drug related as well, is that we... because he was going into rhabdo when this was all going is that we paralyzed him with rocuronium. That way we could avoid the muscles, because the muscles are what was producing the primary source of heat in that case. So paralyzed him after proper sedation, of course, sedation and pain control. So we paralyzed him, and then we did those, like I said, we did basically cold, wet sheets.
Yeah, right. So you had a lot of things going on.
Yeah, because I didn't have ice bath,
right?
You know, as an option. This was, even the cold sheets took some time, and I wasn't really impressed with that drop.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted the fluids in the freezer, and it was kind of a gamble. Like, just say, let's see what happened. But putting in a nice big line to run it through and drop it was, I think, the single thing out of what we did. But that was because of that unique situation. I think, like you said, in EMS, you're not going to have that as a real option.
I'd also say, so first of all, my decimal points were in the right place. I just always panic.
Boom, got it.
I always panic a little bit when I have to do any sort of math off the top of my head, and also metric and Celsius and all that kind of stuff.
Can we just say, let's get rid of Fahrenheit, inches, all this crap? Like, the metric system is so much better.
I agree. Easier to work with. It makes these things very confusing, and it breeds a lot of self-doubt in people like me who are terrible at math in the first place. But okay, so I would suggest in the story that you shared about that patient that the IV fluids were adjunctive and that the more efficient cooling was taking place as a result of some of those other means. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is that just because somebody's a heat stroke patient does not mean that they're necessarily dehydrated. And in fact, some literature shows that most exertional heat stroke patients are not clinically dehydrated. So I think some people are thinking out there that heat stroke and heat illness is synonymous with dehydration, right? These patients are like sweating a lot, they're hot, they're probably low on fluids. I hear that a lot from providers when I'm delivering this kind of education. And that's really just not the case. Most of these patients are actually euvolemic, and so they really just don't need IV fluids for any reason. So there's that concern. And then kind of the other side of that same coin is that, if anything, these patients probably are at risk for hyponatremia. So they are a lot of times sweating a lot. They are losing a lot of sodium through their sweat. And so you'd want to be really careful. It's kind of all the more reason to be a little bit hesitant about giving IV fluids, even if they're chilled, because you might actually contribute to an electrolyte derangement, which could be pretty serious in its own right. So, I think if you have truly cold IV fluids and you have the ability to give them carefully, as it sounds like you did, then I think that's probably fine. It's just not at all going to be my first line treatment. My first thought is going to be, how do I either basically put this person in an ice bath or get as close as possible to that picture?
And I'm glad you brought up the dehydration side, because I totally forgot to mention that, because you're right. You can screw up, especially with saline. I think most of us who are listening to podcasts and most of us who are listening to stuff like this already know that normal saline is anything but normal. And most of the fluids that we're giving are not anything appropriate. And realistically, like you said, in most cases, we don't even need to give in the first place because they are euvolemic usually.
Right. Right on.
So, otherwise, I mean, I think we kind of hit the big thing. So heat stroke, you're looking for changes in sensorum, yep, which I like that. Mm-hmm. We talked about the best way to really cool them down and cool them down quickly, the fastest, most efficient way whenever possible, is using cold water immersion. And we talked about how awesome a beard you have. So, well, used to.
Yeah.
RIP.
RIP, right.
Yeah, it'll come back. Yeah.
It will.
So
as surely as the sun rises, my beard will return.
So what else are we missing here? What else do we need to know? In addition to anyone who's wanting to learn more about this, go to your podcast on this, because it's so well done and covers a lot more detail. We got on a couple of tangents, but I think these are like some of the main pearls that people need to know, as well as some of the potential pitfalls.
Well, so another big thing that I want people to remember is forget sweat. It is irrelevant. The presence or absence of sweating on the patient's skin is irrelevant. Just get it out of your mind. Forget about it. It's meaningless. It tells you nothing.
But the Boy Scouts taught me that it was all about that. I'm serious. Like, I remember, this is one of the few things I remember of heat stroke and heat exhaustion.
Yep. Scouting. And it's on the Orange Man. It's on the Orange Man graphic, which is part of the reason it's so terrible. So again, when you look at literature, when you look at the actual research and people studying this under controlled, circumstances and science, only about 50% of heat stroke patients develop anhidrosis or the lack of sweating. It's a dice roll whether or not the presence or absence of sweat is really going to tell you anything in the first place of clinical value, right? But even if we didn't have those numbers and those studies, just kind of logically, think about a patient who is in a human environment, like somebody who's running a foot race in summertime, right? And they're running and they're running and they're running and they're sweating and they're sweating and they're sweating and they're sweating and everything is fine. They're not suffering any kind of illness or medical emergency. But but they're not able to cope with the heat that they're generating, and they're not able to sweat efficiently because it's a very humid day. And this sweat is just clinging to their skin and soaking their clothes, and then they develop heat stroke and they go down. And you arrive at their side to assess them. Is that sweat on their skin old or new? You know, maybe they have stopped sweating, which would, you know, at least according to these conventional teachings, be, you know, clinically a slam dunk for assessing these patients. Maybe they have actually stopped producing sweat, but you'd really have no effective way of knowing that because they still have sweat lingering on their skin, soaked into their clothing that hasn't evaporated. It tells you nothing about whether or not they actually are in heat stroke. The thing to key in on is the altered mental status. And in fact, the very first heat stroke patient, at least that I can remember treating, the one that I guess left my first impression on me, was a guy running a foot race in August in Washington, D.C., which is a really humid environment right there by the Potomac River and the kind of the Chesapeake Bay area. It's just super muggy. He was running in an area of D.C. Called Foggy Bottom because it used to be a swamp and it was so humid that it would cause this like permanent fog to be settling there. And anybody who's ever been in DC in August knows how insufferable it is, right? So this guy is super sweaty and none of that sweat's evaporating because it was just so freaking humid. And when I reached him, basically what had happened is I was on an EMS bike team, and one of the runners approached us and said, "Hey, somebody collapsed, you know, up there on the course." So we pedal up and we find this guy actually semi upright. He I guess had collapsed, but he wasn't, you know, just like laying, you know, like prostrate out on the ground. He was kind of like sitting upright, almost like rocking back and forth, kind of listless, you know. And I approached him and I, you know, I said, "Hey, my name's David." I was an EMT at that time. I said, my name's David. I'm an EMT. What's going on?" And he said, "My name's Charles." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, Charles, good to meet you. You know, again, I'm David. This is my partner, so-and-so. Somebody said you collapsed. What's going on?" And he said, "My name's Charles." That is not, at that point anymore, a rational or lucid answer to the question. So that's what he kept repeating over and over again. "My name's Charles. My name's Charles." And as he continued to repeat that same phrase over and over and over again, it started getting more like a little bit more like aphasia, you know, like more slurred, more difficulty until he really couldn't speak at all as his temperature, you know, kept rising. And that, you know, like I said, left a big impression on me. And it kind of goes to show you that the sweating thing is irrelevant. And also that this altered sensorium can take a lot of different forms. One of them was presumably that he collapsed, right? So there was some like neurological involvement there with loss of motor control or motor function. Maybe he even did lose consciousness, but at the scene, his expression of that altered sensorium, was that he couldn't participate in the conversation. Obviously that's some sort of alteration of awareness, and increasing difficulty speaking. So, no seizures. He wasn't like combative or agitated. He wasn't unresponsive. He was just, you know, he wasn't acting right. Now, unfortunately, that story did not have a happy ending. He did die. We transported him quickly, but we found out after that he did die from that. And, you know, I wasn't very well educated about heat stroke at that time. And the other crews from other agencies, there's a big interagency, you know, support for this big foot race. They weren't, I think, very well educated either. We didn't have good protocols. And so we were trying to cool this guy with ice packs. We were trying to do kind of the classic ice packs in the groin and axilla and behind the neck. And that stuff just isn't effective. Those things like barely cool the body at all. It's just not going to work. Actual bags of ice might have been a little bit better, but still just not effective. You know, anybody who's ever used these cold packs knows that they just actually don't get that cold. But even if they did, it's important to remember that this ice pack cooling, which is a very popular common teaching point, it just does not cool the body fast enough to make a difference in heat stroke. If you are going to apply those, if that's the only thing that you have, and so that's what you're going to do, it's actually more effective to apply them to the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet and the cheeks of the face than it is to apply them to like the groin and axilla and places like that. Those places, the palms and the cheeks of the face, are relatively thin skin that has a lot of vascularity and a lot of blood flow. So that would be more effective than putting them in like the groin or anything like that. But on the whole, they just don't make a big difference. The big takeaway, I think, for the point that we began this line of conversation on was that sweating, it's useless, it's irrelevant, it doesn't make a difference, get out of there. And when you see information being shared that says that one of the ways to assess a heat stroke patient is the absence of sweating, you should harass them on Facebook. You should point them to Raw Medicine in episode 6, Orange Man Must Die, and you should share with them our evidence-based guide to heat stroke, which points out this folly. Now I'm on a tirade actually, because here's the thing. I just saw a graphic. It was either this morning or yesterday. It was recently, right? Somebody put up an infographic about this where it said how to determine if somebody's in heat stroke: pale, flushed, dry, or moist skin. And I was like, what? I was like, that's all the possible forms of skin that could exist, basically.
And it's supposed to be for heat stroke.
Yeah, exactly. For heat stroke. Now, you know, on the one hand, like, they were on the right path in the sense that the condition of the skin is kind of irrelevant and that, you know, it's not just dry skin that means heat stroke. But on the other hand, it still introduces this idea of skin condition, and people seem hung up on this.
And it's confusing.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's confusing. But people seem really hung up on this idea of skin condition being worth anything in assessing a heat stroke patient, and it's just not.
Well, and that's why I brought the whole thing about the scouts, was because, I mean, we spent so much time focusing on that the real ultra-mental status type stuff, that the thing that really matters for differentiating and identifying is, was basically ignored. It was almost an afterfact. And of course, they taught the same thing about packing ice packs in the groin and axilla and stuff like that. Although the palms and soles of the feet and the cheeks, that's kind of cool. I actually didn't know that one before.
Yeah, it's
makes total sense. Now that you say it, it makes total sense.
Yeah. And you know, these things are all really like adjunctive, right? So again, like anything less than ice water immersion is second fiddle, right? So I think the best way to think of like the cold packs or ice bags on the palms and cheeks is like as a cherry on top of the sundae of other cooling techniques, right? So if the goal is to cool them like as rapidly as possible, like ASAP, get that core temp down, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, cool, 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 which is true, that's what you want to do, then yeah, sure, go ahead and throw them in, right? So like if you don't have that ice bath, then strip their clothing off, douse them with water, put cool sheets on them, rotate the cool sheets, turn up the AC, turn down the AC, make the environment cold, you know, and then, you know, wrap, you know, affix some ice packs to their palms and to their cheeks. And, you know, sure, as like a third or fourth line adjunct, right? So why the hell not? They're really just not as effective as most traditional teaching points have suggested.
So with that being said, anything else that you want to throw in?
I want to point your listeners to some resources on this stuff. One of the best resources for heat illness treatment and research, just all things heat stroke, is the Corey Stringer Institute. Some listeners might remember that Corey Stringer was a football player, a professional football player who died of heat stroke. His legacy, I guess, his survivors helped found this Corey Stringer Institute. They also, as an aside, have a ton of information about other sports medicine related emergencies, things like asthma, anaphylaxis, spinal trauma in the setting of sports and stuff like that. So super, super good research, but they are really on the leading edge of evidence-based treatments for heat illness. And some people from that organization partnered with some other colleagues and came out with a position paper just last year, actually. And the title of the paper is Consensus Statement on the Pre-Hospital Care of Exertional Heat Stroke. And the author list really is kind of a who's who of heat illness experts. And it's really accessible. It's really easy read. You know, it's not one of these super, super dense scientific papers. But they offer a lot of great take-home point. So some of these people from the Corey Stringer Institute, some people from some other institutions got together. And again, it's the consensus statement on the pre-hospital care of exertional heat stroke. Really fantastic research. And then as a third source, the Wilderness Medical Society, of which I'm a proud member. Full disclosure there, I am a fellow in their academy, and I'm a big supporter of their work. But they have a lot of really good evidence-based guidelines, and they actually just did an update to their own guideline on heat illness. They did a 2019 update that was just published basically just this week. And so you can head to the Wilderness Medical Society's website, and you can basically create an account and, you know, access their papers, a lot of which they actually put out for free without any sort of paywall or anything like that. And folks can also subscribe to the Journal of Wilderness and Environmental Medicine to see emerging research on these topics.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much, David, for all of the great material and information. And I truly do appreciate it, because this is something that I'll admit I'm not as strong on this as I probably should be. And I blame part of that because there is so much misinformation out there.
A lot of myths, a lot of dogma.
Yeah, and it's hard to find good, accurate information, because a lot of your trusted, you know, quote unquote trusted resources are some of the ones perpetuating it. It's kind of like the whole fentanyl thing, like we were talking about earlier. I mean, there are organizations and groups for one reason or another that manage to kind of screw it up for everyone, so it makes it hard to even understand. Mm-hmm. But I really do appreciate you with your efforts and what you've done to try and help perpetuate the better evidence and facts behind this. Without further ado, can you give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.